Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello there. My name is Miles Jupp, and I'm just interrupting you as you listen to whatever it is that you actually want to listen to tell you about the second series of Middle Please Umpire. Middle Please Umpire is a podcast that I, Miles Jupp, if you weren't concentrating when I first introduced myself only moments ago, that's not a criticism, your thoughts are your own and you must focus them wheresoever you yourself choose, host with Mark Wood, the 95-mile-an-hour bowling, England-playing, World Cup-winning, Northumberland-hailing cricket lunatic Mark Wood. It's another series of episodes of the two of us talking about cricket and indeed any other stuff that springs to mind, both with each other and also with a succession of frankly illustrious guests. We lift the lid on Mark's life as an international sportsman, basically he spends a lot of time icing himself, and take you on a whistle-stop journey through the windmills of his mind. I, a mere fan, listen agog, giggle excitedly, and try and draw comparisons with my own rather more mundane existence. All episodes of Middle Please Umpire are available right now from your favourite podcast providers.
Hello, and welcome to Stop Hammer Time. My name is Phil Whelans, and with me this week are Jim Grant.
Good evening.
Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Also, well? It's, yes, not too bad. You?
Yeah, I'm good.
Good. Back again. It's always wonderful to have him. It is a journalist and author. He is author of several books, West Ham related, Irons in the Soul, Hammers in the Heart. And I think the most recent one was Goodbye to Boleyn, but also like other books, Hoovy and Dad, Joy of Essex, Man About Tarn, and the most recent, What Are Words Worth? It is journalist and author Pete May. Hello, Pete.
Good to be here.
It's Goodbye. You haven't squeezed out another book about West Ham since Goodbye to Boleyn.
No. There could be one about the attempt to sabotage our Champions League effort. But
that's right. Yes. I think you should.
That's the end of the season. Yeah.
You should start. Start scribbling right now, Pete, and get that. Yeah. Goodbye to Boleyn is excellent. It's an excellent book and a very good sort of nostalgic jog through our time at said stadium. I enjoyed it immensely. Also with us, it is a tech and video game writer, employee of a huge amount of newspapers during the time when the print medium was at its height and its most successful. He has adapted like not the shark, which hasn't adapted over millions of years. He has adapted like RoboCop adapted from being an ordinary policeman to a cybernetic policeman mainly made of machinery and servos, but with a human brain, which is very much what this guest has. It is Director of Newsroom Innovation at The Telegraph, Dan Silver. Hello, Dan.
Hello, thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Thanks. Is that the best introduction you've ever received, Dan?
It's the best I've had this week, for sure.
Right, oh, great, excellent. Well, that's set the benchmark pretty high for me. I might have to introduce you again in a few minutes. But We've got a few things to talk about this weekend. Obviously, a bombshell has struck the world of football in the last 48 hours, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But first of all, over the weekend, it was announced that, with immediate effect, Sheffield United will break away from the Premier League, sparking a wave of powerful reactions around the country. Boris Johnson has vowed to do everything in his power to allow this to happen. And Gary Neville's impassioned shrug captured the national mood. Sheffield United, famously immortalised in the expression "Go fuck yourself, Sheffield United," said the decision was in no way motivated by money. It was purely a footballing matter, specifically not being good at football. Consigned as they were to the drop by Newcastle's victory at the weekend, the Blades immediately pledged to take legal action against West Ham United for fielding an eligible player. They contend that under the terms of his contract, Craig Dawson is subject to second-party ownership by the club, which is expressly permitted under FA regulations. How else can you explain West Ham's decision to play Dawson, said a furious spokesman for the Blades, other than that he was available? Henry Winter, as in, "You too, Henry Winter, I haven't forgotten about you," has already offered to appear as a witness and write some dossier or something about Craig Dawson and be all like, "Oh, look at me, I'm an expert on football and that." Where the fuck does he get off? And Sean Bean, Jesus wept, I don't even know where to start. Fuck me. That was in the Financial Times sports.
I recognised the sort of, you know, the reportage style.
Very much. The Financial Times is adopting a kind of beat poet's stream of consciousness, like Allen Ginsberg's Howl or The Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. That's what the Financial Times is like now, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
A lot of it's online. It's like a cybernetic. It's mainly a cybernetic newspaper now that's mainly online. Events have somewhat overtaken the fact that we played a game of football. The Hams played the Browns up at Newcastle at the weekend, and we lost. It was a unusual experience to lose a game of football. Such a talented and gifted side are we. We had drawn and won two, and then with the same scoreline as the ones we won, we lost. What do we make of it? What do you make? Dan, what did you make of it?
I had quite a surreal experience on Saturday, actually.
Did you take magic mushrooms, Dan?
I took magic AstraZeneca.
Ah.
I had forgotten. I thought we were playing at 3 o'clock, so I'd scheduled my jab up at Guy's Hospital for 1:05, thinking I'd brilliantly get back in time to see the kickoff.
Right.
And obviously, we were kicking off at 12:30, so I scheduled it right in the middle of Craig Dawson's mad minute.
Yes.
So we recorded the game and then did a likely lads trying to get back and not knowing what had happened to watch it. So I was a couple of hours behind everybody else. So while you were all kind of elated, I was very much despaired and went through that cycle, which is a long-winded way of saying I thought it was quite a disappointing result, but quite an entertaining game.
It was,
And I think, you know, I've seen obviously the hand-wringing and the pearl clutching on social media, but I think if you'd have given any of us, you know, 7 points from the three games we just played with
absolutely
our arm off, even 6 points from the three games we'd just played with a bit in your arm off, but they just came in a surprising order. You know,
I lost to
Leicester and beaten Newcastle. And I think such was the overconfidence going into this game amongst the fan base that it felt like a catastrophic defeat, whereas in fact, you know, it was a sort of self-inflicted first half and a very, very spirited and impressive second half performance.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree, really. I mean, I was expecting that to be a difficult game, and you know, and at some stage, I just thought those injuries are going to have to prove costly without Rice, without Antonio, and I think we really missed Cresswell. You know, we missed his crosses.
We did, yeah.
Even Arthur Masuaku, you know, might have made a bit of a difference. So, you know, I knew lots of people were expecting us to win, but they were fighting for their lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of thought after the season we've had, You know, it's not a disaster to lose one game, and you can't really legislate for suddenly Craig Dawson turned into the Dawson we knew at Watford instead.
Yes, yeah.
The rest of and yeah, I mean, you couldn't, that and the Fabianski era, I mean, there's not a lot you could do about
no,
that. No. Disappointing at the end, though, obviously, having got back. Yeah.
Jim.
But we played
the character, so not a disaster.
Jim. No. Yeah, I mean, I said on the podcast last week that I feared this was the big banana skin. And we just crammed a kind of, you know, half a season's worth of individual errors into a single half. And we haven't made many this season. You know, in the end, you know, it catches up with you. Newcastle were up for it in the first half, but we were... I felt, you know, at the time that the crucial sort of mistake for the first goal came, I thought we'd weathered that, and I thought we were beginning to sort of settle into the game. Actually, the second half, I thought with 10 men, I thought some of the football we played was fantastic, and we won the second half, which is all you could really have asked of them. And it was just such a shame they switched off after getting back into it for the third goal, because I think we deserved a point out of the game, to be honest.
I thought for that, until our mad 5 minutes from minutes 36 to 41, one thing I thought was that they managed us very well. Their game plan was very good. They sat deep, but they didn't soak it up. They employed what one of the pundits called, and this is an expression I've never heard, and she might have made it up. It was that Alex lady on Match of the Two. She said a low press as opposed to a high press. She said this was a low press, which I think she made up in a fit of, I think maybe she was on opium and she just made up the expression low press just to impress, you know, whoever, should Danny Murphy or whoever was with her. And I've done that. I've made up words to just try and impress women that I'm with. And they've simply extemporated me. And but I thought that they, you know, what they did was they did sit back, but they weren't sitting back. They were very busy. I've never, and I like John Joe Shelvey, I've never seen him be that busy. You know, they came out and closed space down in front of all our attacking players extremely well. And one thing I thought was, because that meant we could play higher up the pitch, there was a time not long before that blunder fiesta where Mark Noble was sort of in an Ian Bishop type pulling the strings position in the middle of the park. He ran several yards to his left, put his foot on the ball, turned round, ran to the right, did his famous 360 degrees and then passed it like 2 yards to a player that, you know, that had made himself available next to him. And I just thought, we have to, if a team does this, of course we've got to be patient and pick our way through them, but we've got to do it with some sort of speed, you know.
Absolutely. The tempo wasn't there, and he really slowed us down, I think, you know, in that first half. I mean, he'd done such a good job, you know, in the previous games.
That,
you know, in a different kind of game, in a different tactical
That's right.
game.
And by no means, and, you know, slagging him off.
We needed to play that at a much, much higher tempo, because they just, you know, when they got in sort of set into position, we didn't have a means really of picking our way through it. And Lingard had a quiet first half. He had his probably his quietest first, you know, half of
and I think they had a lot to do with that. They had a lot to do with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think they know. Kept him quiet. Yeah. They'd, you know, done their homework, you know. Yeah. And of course, they had the threat of Saint-Maximin on the break, who was excellent in the first half, you know, really, really, really pacey. You know, fair play to them. They're possibly in a slightly false position. They've got some good players. With the possible exception. Well, even Sheffield United we struggled against, didn't we, to a certain extent up there. So there are no, as they say, it's the cliche, there are no easy games.
I mean, ironically, I think maybe Noble at the end might have been more useful.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's when we suddenly looked wide open, as when they got the winner.
Well, actually, yeah. we sort of reverted to type, because they Newcastle went into a kind of tailspin of panic once we scored those two goals for them. Like and so the second half, the entirety of the second half performance, if not the kind of remaining 10 minutes of the first half, we looked much more like the West Ham of the previous two or three games. And in fact, Noble played very well, I thought, in that bit until he went off. You know, people sort of talk about sort of tactics of managers and stuff. And if Moyes had sort of had a crystal ball and seen how Newcastle were going to play for those first 35 minutes, I think he could conceivably not have had a three-man central defence. Mm. I think, you know, because Ben Johnson, I don't think there's a lot to choose between Ben Johnson as a left-back and Ben Johnson as a left-wing-back. You know, part of that three at the back strategy was to sort of release Masuaku to be just a wing back rather than a catastrophic left back. And I wondered whether, in fact, Moyes did it because he knows we've got these games coming up. He wanted to give Angelo Ogbonna some game time, but didn't want to, you know, put him out with just one central defensive partner. So he sort of thought, oh, I know, I'll play three at the back, bring Angelo, put that in that, and have wing-backs. But in fact, I think we could have played 4-4-2 in that game.
Possibly. I think he was concerned about the pace of Sam Attema. I think that would have been a factor. I said at the time, I wouldn't have minded seeing Fredericks just deployed to match him for pace. As you know... I think season four last, Fredericks played. We did particularly well, I thought, at home against Liverpool. It was when they got that offside goal, and Fredericks played in that game and was superb against Mane, I think. You know, so
yes, absolutely. And I mean, I don't know. You know, that's a choice between two blokes playing on the wrong side, and I sort of think that Fredericks would make as good a makeshift left back as Ben Johnson, and is quicker than Ben Johnson. Mm. Yeah, but again, you know, I don't think, you know, Moyes hasn't got a crystal ball and can't predict the way Newcastle are going to play, because I don't think, I don't, you know, the times we've played them before, when they've had Saint-Maximin and Almiron in the team, they have sat back and soaked it up like an away team and pumped balls over the top of us. And they weren't doing that this time. And Moyes wasn't to know that they weren't going to do that. But I think he could have played 4-4-2 probably in that game, which might have released a spot for Benrahma to be more sort of in the team and more creative.
Yeah. But it's like you say, you know, teams lose football matches. You know, I think if you look at the last four games, the four fixtures, Arsenal, Wolves away, Leicester home, Newcastle away, you know, to come out of those four fixtures with 7 points is probably what most of us would have expected at best, really, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're still in there and fighting, aren't we?
I mean, there was something gloriously West Ham about managing to lose a goal and have a player sent off. You know?
Yeah, in the same move. Yeah.
Teams that could do that. Yeah,
it was. I mean, it was an extraordinary passage of 5 minutes of football, wasn't it? You know, I don't know. Yeah, sort of
my control from Craig Dawson there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we were, you know, I sort of think we were a little bit shaken by that sort of, you know, daft goal and still slightly thinking about it when, you know, the corner came over for the second one. It's so quiet that I think you hear Fabianski sort of go, keepers, and then drop it. So he was essentially lying.
Noah Linton score.
Yes. He should have been sued for misadvertising what was about to happen. But yeah, you know, it was sort of when it came down to 8 games to go after 30, I wrote those games down on a piece of paper, which I now have for every podcast. And really, you sort of, you know, you can't expect us to win every one of those games. And, you know, so far we have won one of the slightly more difficult ones, which was Leicester. You know, as you said, Dan, looking at the last few games we've played, we've probably got the points total we could reasonably expect, just in a slightly odd order.
This is, I mean, this is the funny thing about being a successful team that I think none of us are used to, and we're struggling to come to terms with the fact that you do suddenly start to expect to win games.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's an unusual feeling. And then when you lose those games you expect to win, we're kind of not really sure how to react. I mean, I've kind of been saying recently that I'm finding this Champions League challenge as, if not more stressful than a relegation battle.
Because
in a relegation battle, you kind of expect to win one or two. You know, there's one or two games you kind of look at and you think, we'll win those. Whereas when you were competing for the Champions League, you have to win every game. If you lose, if you lose once, it's a massive setback. And it just seems to be much more stressful. And I think that combined with the fact that, you know, it feels like a kind of once in a generation type opportunity. I mean, you know, yesterday it looked like we were going to win the league. Now it looks like we might be going back into the Champions League. And that combined with the fact that, you know, our squad is essentially held together with string and sellotape.
Yeah.
This makes it a really stressful experience. And I can't say I'm really enjoying us being a successful team at the moment because the stress of expecting us to win is just getting too much to bear.
I agree with you about the tension, but I think it's an enjoyable tension. It is like, you know, how you feel before cup finals and things. Whereas, you know, the nerves and stress when you're facing, you know, a relegation battle, it is that you do go into those games just expecting the worst, and therefore, you know, every little crumb of comfort, you know, hits home. So, I kind of agree with you, but I am enjoying it. The nervous tension.
I must say that the stress at the end of the Leicester game was, I think, more stressful than the relegation situation that I can remember in the last few years.
Yeah.
That final corner, my God.
You needed to be like watching it with, you know, a priest with you, like somebody on death row who gets a priest to visit them at the last. It was extraordinary. You know, I think for those teams that are sort of, you know, maybe they're ahead of the entire division and they're just sort of, the possibility is that they might be caught, you know, it becomes what it's felt like a lot to me, which is just, you know, just try not to lose and just keep putting some points on the board every game. And that was, you know, we've got 3 points against Leicester. We very nearly got a draw against Newcastle in a game where, lest we forget, we played an hour with 10 men. And, you know, that's quite an accomplishment. And, you know, we go again. And each of these games, I think we, you know, the fact that we didn't sort of collapse when we went down to 10 men was a you know, quite a testament to the spirit in the side. I mean, they just didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know the first half of the first half of the second half, the third quarter of the game. We were just absolutely rampant, you know, and it's just a shame we couldn't have sort of stuck, you know, another one in.
And I think that
I thought Fornals in particular was just magnificent in that game. In that second, he was just everywhere, cropping up everywhere. He ran and ran and ran. I love his energy and his passion for the game, really. And it was interesting that he was one of the I think was the only West Ham player who came out and said anything about the Super League thing earlier on, and you know, expressed the same, or you know, sentiments that a lot of people have expressed, but it was good to see, I think.
You know, it was sort of an encouraging game. It's potentially harder on paper game we've got coming up at the weekend, Chelsea, which we'll talk about at the end. But we really ought to talk about this European Super League stuff, and we'll do that after this message.
If you want an e-bike that doesn't look like it's made for the shopping precinct, something that's less Mr. Bean and more Steve McQueen, check out the range of bikes from London-based Cooler King. From dope 250-watt city bikes to Harley Bobber-inspired 750-watt beasts that can tear your face off while leaving your smile intact. Cooler Kings are made in limited numbers, yet highly affordable. Check them out now on the web at cooler.bike or find them on Instagram with hashtag CoolerKingBike. Cooler.bike. E-bikes that are cool AF.
Welcome back. Some of you guys have seen further sort of developments over the course of today, which I failed to see. But yes, a very strange thing. You know, Sunday night, wasn't it? The first I saw was Gary Neville's furious rant.
Yeah.
So I had to look on the BBC website at what this story was. So I sort of read the thing, and actually I just kind of went, well, it's just sort of Kerry Packer again, isn't it? Or, you know, that sort of Indian Super League, or, you know, the fact that the boxing, you know, after sort of Muhammad Ali and Joe Bugner and all the boxers from George Foreman from when we were kids, throughout the 80s and 90s, there were about 9 world champions, and the whole thing was a kind of you know, torturous clusterfuck where no one really won anything. And I sort of thought they'll do it for a couple of years, and then, you know, they'll find a way with their tail between their legs to sort of somehow combine it with the Champions League again, if the Champions League goes ahead without those 15 teams in it or 12 teams in it. But then I think when I read the story, the BBC, I don't know if the BBC's reporting was kind of editorialising it or whether they were sort of quoting a statement from the 12 teams. But of course, that statement sort of said the competition will take place during the week. And then, of course, at the weekend, we will go back and play in our, you know, Serie A and the Premier League and La Liga. And I think it was then that I sort of thought, oh, will they? Won't they? Were there? Is that, are they saying that, or has everyone said that? And then it, you know, seemed, oh, I sort of thought, oh, that's what the rage is about. They might get kicked out of the Premier League and various other competitions. And that was when I sort of thought, ah, this is what people are sort of furious about. Very strange if they assume that they would just be able to do this thing and then play in their domestic leagues at the weekend. Do we think that that's what they thought? They just assumed that everyone would go, oh, yeah, that's fine. Go and do this new thing in the week. We'll see you on Saturday.
What they felt they were leaving was UEFA and the Champions League. They didn't, I don't think, see it as abandoning their own. But, of course, they didn't really quite follow through what the reactions that be. And also the illogic, I mean, the impossibility, really, of them carrying on playing in a league amongst themselves, which is a closed shop, in which they're playing these kind of mega bucks games against each other midweek, and then competing in theory in highly intense competition in the leagues of the weekend. They were just going to end up with so much money they'd have a squad for the Premier League and put out a week, you know, their B team would play in the Premier League effectively. You know, that's where it would have gone. But I think the real rage, Phil, was about the essential undermining of the kind of principles on which what's European football is based, which is a competitive league pyramid structure in which the lowliest of teams with investment and or, you know, improvement and good management and skill can rise to the very top. It's about, you know, what we find thrilling as football fans is Leicester winning the Premier League, West Ham challenging at the top, you know, the up and down, so, you know, the movement of through the leagues of, you know, look at the, you know, the number of teams that have played in the Premier League since its inception is very, very kind of large number. Going, you know, Bradford and Barnsley, and you know, so supporters of teams even now in the National League or in League Two can dream of the idea that they might eventually see their team rise through that structure. Mm. And I think American owners in particular just don't get that. They just don't understand it. They have no. That's not how American sport works with its franchise system and so on. I think they massively kind of misread the reaction. And it also smacks potentially of kind of financial desperation on the part of one or two of them.
because they're all heavily leveraged, aren't they, with debt and whatever. And clearly, you know, they've eaten up huge resources already, which they've spent on, you know, kind of Stadia and Galactico players and agents fees and all this kind of mega things that they've created. And now they just want kind of more. That's you know, we have allowed in to football this insatiable monster, and the roots of this go way, way back. It was a bit of a kind of shock when it came out, but we've been building towards this ever since the kind of the Premier League began. Really, I mean, this is where it's all logically been heading. If you have these super billionaire owners, this is what they're going to want.
Fellas, what do you make of it?
They don't want the risk of losing their money.
What do you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, you know, this is merely like the formal codification of what's been happening, as you say, Jim, over the last 20 years. I mean, the Champions League practically is a closed shop. The big teams, the power brokers in Europe have forced concessions year after year in order to make it harder for other teams to qualify for it. And this is basically... The timing of this is shocking because obviously it's in the middle of a pandemic, but they've basically looked and gone, well, you know, there's several of us that probably won't qualify for it this year, so why not? Let's just actually close the shop instead of having a pretend closed shop, and just make sure we have a tournament that we can't fail to qualify for. I mean, it's just the logical extension of where the game's been going. So anyone who's kind of surprised by this, I think, has just not been paying attention for the last 20 years. You know, it's just the timing that has been a surprise. The fact that it's fallen apart, I think, is incredible. And I agree, Jim, that they kind of underestimated the response. But I think they just thought it wouldn't be a thing. You know, none of the fans in this continent factored into any of these plans. You know, this was a move to make a global content proposition for people in North America, for people in Asia, for people in the Middle East. You know, the fact it was announced at 11 o'clock on a Sunday when Europe's asleep and those other
countries. Well, yeah.
We are the legacy fans. You know,
it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? It's a sort of like... You know, why did it come out of nowhere, and why did they ambush us with the news? I mean, it's clearly when you've got a big surprise for someone that you're sort of keeping carefully under wraps for ages, it's either going to be like that when David Bowie suddenly put out a single when he hadn't done anything for 10 years. It's either going to be that, or it's going to be something like Pearl Harbor. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be like really bad news or really good news. And of course, it was really bad news. It's the fact that they sort of knew it was bad news. And that's why it was like sort of phrased in this way that, like, you know, it's just a midweek thing. Don't worry about it. It's just, we'll be back. We'll be back playing football at the weekend. And you just think, but everyone will hate you. I mean,
was it the whole thing to stop West Ham, you know? It could have been across the whole of Europe.
A long, long plan to prevent West Ham from ever achieving anything.
By any means necessary.
This plan started in 1967 after Bobby Moore, Martin Peters and Jeff Hayes. It's like it's like QAnon, theory that football has essentially been predicated on not letting West Ham achieve anything.
Yes.
I mean, it was either an attempt to upstage the whole kind of, you know, reorganisation announcements about the Champions League, the Swiss League system that was coming in, you know, sort of to undermine that. Or you sort of got that sense that maybe they had to go live with it because it was going to be leaked or something like that. Because you'd expect there to, with these kind of their business empires or whatever, there to have been a really slick PR machine ready to roll for this. And that, and actually there wasn't, was there? And there weren't spokespeople. Nobody was coming out and kind of, apart from the Real Madrid guy blathering on, talking the most
saving
extraordinary
football.
Hypocritical shit I've ever heard anyone speak, actually. What kind of idiots does he take people for, you know? Oh, it's young people have gone off football. We're going to have to make the game shorter.
Young people hate
football. Save the game. That's what he was saying. That's his argument.
Young people hate football. They've gone off it.
Because that's the other thing about it. Where it was all headed. I mean, clearly these particularly the American owners. But you know, this has been the game plan from the moment they bought into the whole deal. I mean, they wouldn't have been just going to happy. They've seen this as the massive global, you know, investment opportunity. They were going to be outside UEFA and FIFA. And so therefore able to, so it wasn't just a kind of simple breakaway. It was a breakaway much more akin to great schisms that have, like the one that, you know, happened with rugby league and rugby union. They would be free to change the laws of the game, rearrange it in the way that they wanted. So you almost have two different codes of football in a way.
And I think that one of the kind of big misnomers of the last few days is everyone calling it the European Super League. At no point did they call it the European Super League. They called it the Super League. So the fact that it was just European teams announced at the moment, you know, if I can put my full kind of tin hat on, my tinfoil hat rather, you know, I think they were moving to a place where they could bring in teams from other continents and then they could start franchising. And, you know, I think if this plan would have gone ahead, I don't think it would have been beyond the realms that, you know, they would have moved teams around as they do in North American sports. And, you know, if all the Arsenal fans decided they didn't want to go to this, fine, we'll move Arsenal to Abu Dhabi, you know. I think their end goal here, as you say, Jim, was just to create an entirely new code that they could do whatever they wanted with. And the fans were just collateral damage in kind of moving all this stuff around to suit their own ends. I mean, it's genuinely shameful that it was allowed to get this far.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it has concentrated people's minds on what we do value about football.
Yes.
How it is nothing without that competitiveness. And I just wonder, you know, in this league, you know, if there's two teams, five places from the bottom and six from bottom towards the end of the season, you know, who can't get relegated, you know, who would have watched it? You know, would you actually tune in to...
Yeah, I think Dan's sort of view of it is absolutely right. Sort of, you know, it sort of occurred to me that essentially the amounts of money they're talking about, they see football as a kind of television sport. And when, you know, with this notion that you might see Manchester United playing Boca Juniors or River Plate or Corinthians at some point, it's, you know, you could see it being this sort of model that in a sense... the game is essentially a television game, and that you get to see your heroes at a massive stadium in the way that, you know, you listen to a group's record, you know, all the time. And then every couple of years they go on tour and you go, I can actually see, you know, Damon Albarn or, you know, St. Vincent or someone like that, because they're on tour and I can see them. You don't really see it as a sort of spectator sport. You see it as a TV support that's supported by big live events, which are these, you know, marquee games. You know, one of the sort of drivers of this thing was like, over the course of the Champions League, you play too many shitty teams. Manchester United play RB Leipzig and, you know, Panathinaikos, whereas really what people want to see is they want to see them play Real Madrid. And you just go, well, then those would just be demonstration games. They might actually, in a kind of closed circuit league, be pretty shitty games as well. You know, fairly evenly matched teams, you know, sort of in this tournament where they see each other every year and play out this kind of tournament. But, you know, that Real Madrid chairman or whatever, you know, I think it's Barcelona that are £1 billion in debt. And talking about these amounts of money, you know, I think it... You know, they're talking about this Haaland guy, this, what is he, Norwegian striker, being possibly the first £1 million a week footballer. And I think this financial model of football is just simply not sustainable.
No, it's not.
You know,
I mean, we've got to be, I mean, clearly, you know, this has been, as we said, been going this way for a long time. And you know, there's some irony in UEFA and FIFA, you know, stepping up now and sort of defending the principles and the ethics of a game when they've allowed a World Cup to take place in Qatar, in plainly like corruption in plain sight, wasn't it, really?
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, the whole thing has blood on its hands because, you know, if essentially slave workers have died building those stadiums. And you know, yeah, not much, there hasn't been much protest really about that. But I think one would hope, seeing as it is now, as we have sort of, as we are doing this podcast, crumbling away with Man City and Chelsea withdrawing. I think Barcelona apparently have said they're not going to do it now. So the whole thing is kind of falling apart. You have to wonder if the kind of the hope is that out of this moment of overreach, we might all collectively kind of football might collectively take a look at things and think, well, you know, we just really need to get a number of things in order, like potentially capping transfer fees or salaries,
yeah.
You know, some kind of body independent of the Premier League, whatever, you know, set up to oversee and look after the sport as a whole, grassroots and all. You know, I mean, it might be that out of this will come some kind of good. I suppose I'm an eternal optimist, but
So what is the latest? What is has happened? Because I yesterday morning I was sort of thinking very, you know, idly in the shower or doing the wash up or something. I was thinking, yeah, what about Manchester United and Chelsea? Because they don't, you know, they don't run sport for a living like the Fenway Group and Kroenke and the Glazers. You know, what they, you know, Abramovich blackmails authorities and kills people for a living, and the other country rapes the natural resources of that region for its money and stones women. And so it's quite interesting that they were sort of the two of the first ones to pull out, if that is sort of what's happened, because I think that probably is, you know, they're kind of going, well, we don't really need this as much as, you know, everyone else claims.
Well, yes, possibly. But in terms of the money, that might be true. But and the story was that that City and Chelsea were, you know, the most reluctant. But of course, once it was clear the others were going, didn't want to be kind of left.
Yeah, of course.
Left behind. I mean,
there must have been a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, the fallout is going to be, you know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of fallout. And of course, actually, they've signed contracts. They have broken Rule 9 of the Premier League. So there needs to be some kind of punishment for what they've done. And I'm not quite sure what the rules are or what kind of how that would go. But they can't just sort of, having done this, suddenly roll back and say, we were just joshing. We're just kidding with you. I mean, well,
That initial you know, statement from the 12 clubs, this sort of notion that, yeah, we'll just be back playing in our domestic leagues at the weekend. I don't know if it must have occurred to them that they might not be let back or there might be some sort of sanctions. I mean, I've seen the words written down, they're not allowed to punish us, you know, essentially that sentiment expressed that we're perfectly within our rights to do this. But that sort of, I've also seen a screen grab of that sort of Rule 9 bit of whoever it is, FIFA or UEFA or the FA.
That's the Premier League.
Yeah, the Premier League.
But I don't think they expected the government to react so quickly either.
No.
Or all three parties to be united.
Spurs
were the last team left. That's what I'm hoping happens.
I mean,
Spurs will stick it out for as long as they can. It's the only table they've ever got a top in, isn't it?
They will win it.
It's sort of extraordinary that, I mean, it's almost perfect for the worst element of Tottenham Hotspurs fans, who are obsessed with the abstract notion of being a big club. Trademark. That there's just this thing that says you're a big club. Sorry, Dan.
There's a one in the year as well, Phil. So there's a one in the year. So they're due to win the title this
year.
They are.
Yes, so of course.
The one
yes. So
I mean, they might not have had a big kind of PR thing ready to roll, but they apparently have, I mean, they've got lawyers ready to roll, haven't they? There's already been some injunction in Madrid about that they can't stop people playing for their international teams, that UEFA can't. So I imagine they are very tooled up in terms of litigation and were prepared for legal battles over these sorts of things, which, of course, could drag on, you know, for years potentially. So whatever punishment might come their way, it'll be fought over. But of course, it might end up being kind of, you know, the individual clubs kind of on their own. I mean, this entity of a Super League might not exist. Who actually is the big cheese, the big brain behind this? I mean, none of that has emerged, has it really? Who are the prime movers?
No.
But also, Jim, I think like their legal arguments would all have been about allowing them to play in this league, and now they're going to have to reverse ferret, and their legal arguments have to be about allowing them to keep in the existing leagues.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
You wonder how prepared they are for that about turn. I mean, I think it's fascinating, and you know, I can't wait to see what happens next. I mean, you know, we were briefly discussing this earlier, but they have to face sanctions, and they have to face the most severe sanctions, because they've actively plotted and conspired to undermine and effectively kill the league that they compete in. So, you know, they have to be made an example of, and they have to be punished so this kind of thing doesn't happen again. I mean, points deduction, relegation, I think this all has to be on the table.
Make them be 51% owned by the fans, like in Germany, you know, follow that.
Well, I mean, clearly that has been part of what's kept the German, restrained the German teams from. I mean, you know, I think they were a Dortmund, a Bayern Munich and a PSG away from this actually happening, you know, probably. PSG are Qatari-owned, aren't they? So you can see why politically they might have, you know, they owe a lot, don't they, to FIFA and to UEFA by association. So you can see why they might have stayed loyal in that respect. But in Germany, there are different rules about club ownership, aren't there, which seem to be much more sensible.
Yeah, it's only sensible.
To have a fan representation of that level.
I think the annoying thing is that we might have missed our opportunity to reset the game in this country. If those six had gone, then that would have given the rest of us a chance to actually reset football in the UK. Now they've remained with us. We've almost missed that opportunity. You know, Jim, friend of this show, wrote a very good blog about it this morning, when we still thought they were going. But, you know, this is our great opportunity to reset the game in the UK. And I think that, unfortunately, that horse has bolted.
But what would happen if they did go, if they actually left and weren't in the Premier League anymore? So they just play those midweek games in this new competition they've got, which is how many? It's two teams of 10, so there's 9. So there's 18 games if they just play everyone twice in a sort of league in those two groups of 10, because it's the 12 plus 3 plus 5 that have to qualify. And then I guess some working towards the final. So it's only going to be about 24 games a season instead of a team that plays its domestic league and plays in the Champions League, who are going to play close to 40 games.
They're planning a league and then some kind of knockout with the top half of it at the end.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's only going to be like, you know, early 20s games for each of those teams. Yeah. So, I mean, it would be sort of catastrophic for them, I would have thought.
Well, they could a lot of time to go on tours of, you know, Middle Eastern tours of Australia and
play sort of weird friendlies.
It's about, I think, you know, if you look at where the thinking is coming, it's from this American model of sports, and it's about creating this enormous content. I mean, most American football franchises only play 16 games in a season, like 8 home games in a season. But it's wall-to-wall coverage of who's on their roster, who are they trade. You know, there's huge amounts of TV studio verbiage that people get very, very sucked into. It's all very statistical. American sports are always very statistics orientated, aren't they? And people get very nerdy about them. Mm. And So, you know, it's a very, very, very short season in terms of the actual action, but an enormous content generator in terms of kind of revenue through television and so on. So I think that's probably what the kind of plan was to generate a huge kind of televisual, kind of every game being a kind of big event that's talked about, you know, game week, you know, shows leading up to it and so on.
Again, entirely televisual, you know, it's basically seeing it as a TV medium rather than a live medium. And in a way, the live games support the television sort of iteration of that game, you know, and that's why it sort of makes the sort of remarks by the Real Madrid chairman sort of so, you know, stupid. It's like if these teams have sort of leveraged themselves into so much debt and then sort of blame the game for not making them enough money. You know, you go, the game's been fucking here for a long time, decades before you fucking turned up, and people sort of did okay by it. If it doesn't make enough money, it's like kind of going, oh, I'd like to be able to monetize nitrogen, which is sort of in the air. People will kick a fucking football around all the time. If you're going, oh, this concept, this sort of sport where 11 blokes play each other, we can't sort of make enough money out of it. Why don't you just make the fucking amount of money that's there to be made out of it rather than going, oh, that's not enough, we need more. And that would start with not playing this sort of Norwegian man child £1 million a week. Don't fucking do that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
it's like absolutely. There was,
you know, there was a time in the early 90s when adverts were incredibly lucrative things for actors to do. I did one for Pizza Hut and I got like a couple of grand. But then when they started doing that, you know, when the one with Gareth Southgate and Stuart Pearce always hit the post, that one, they had a little run of having sort of celebs in Pizza Hut adverts. And at the time, I knew Caroline Quentin, who was sort of in Men Behaving Badly, probably at the time, and maybe even Jonathan Creek as well. And she didn't like doing it. She didn't want to do adverts, and she got offered $100,000 to do a Pizza Hut advert. And in order to sort of stick two fingers up, she told her agent to ask for twice as much, and they said yes. She got £200,000 to act in a commercial. Now that doesn't happen. There was a sort of reset. It involved actors going on strike and sort of scab labor acting in adverts and stuff, but there was a big reset. That literally doesn't happen anymore. People do an ad and they might get like $6,000 or something. You know, they just don't get $70,000 or $40,000 or $35,000 or $200,000. They just don't get that. They get like $6,000 or $7,000 or something like that, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the kind of, it is about money. It's the old kind of, you know, price of everything, value of nothing things. I mean, years ago, I read a book about the history of West Ham United by an American academic called Charles Corr. It's a very, very good book. I think it is just called West Ham United. I lent it to someone and never got it back. But I remember that you know, he begins that book by telling the story of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who, of course, in sometime in the 50s or 60s, were just moved by their owner to look, because it was sunnier and not, you know, and literally the first thing the fans knew about it was turning up at the stadium to kind of renew their season tickets, and there were just signs up, we've moved to LA, the other side of the country.
Yeah, Oakland,
and I was reminded of that with, you know, the lack of consultation with anybody before this announcement came, reminded me of that. But it also, you know, the point he makes in the book is that, oh, this couldn't happen in England, because in England, sport is rooted in working class, football in particular, rooted in working class culture. West Ham is a team rooted in its East End environs and its history and where it's come from, of that kind of Docklands heritage. And that, you know, and that all the, you know, you can see it in the nicknames, not silly kind of silly stout stick-on names that American, like Titans or Jaguars or whatever the American teams have. You know, English teams have nicknames rooted in the industrial heritage of the places they come from. And this, you know, and badges that reflect that. And you have generations of fans brought up with the culture of their club, you know. We know as West Ham fans that we're a London team, but we're very different from Chelsea, and we know that, you know. and we understand that.
That's racist.
It's striking how many of those chairmen don't go to games. I mean, Abramovich occasionally.
Yeah.
He's not allowed in the country anymore, is he, Abramovich?
No, he can't go to many, but I don't think anyone ever actually see the clubs.
Yeah.
Think about at least Gold and Sullivan do actually go to games. I think they've realised how angry the fans would have been, say, if they'd signed up for it. They've issued a statement today, belatedly.
Yeah. You wonder, what would their... I mean, do we think... What would have Everton, West Ham, Leicester have done if they'd have been invited, do you think?
I think they would have bitten their hands off.
Yeah.
100%.
Aaron Brady probably would.
Jim, sort of for a long time, for decades, you've sort of posited the idea that there would be a kind of closed, there would eventually be a closed circuit football sort of thing. You know, I can remember you saying that, that it might have, you know, like it might include sort of Rangers and Celtic at the time and sort of, you know, kind of maybe some of the bigger, even possibly the more traditionally big English clubs, because they get a lot of fans going. So, you know, Forest and Wednesday and Leeds would be in there as well. And that there would possibly be a closed circuit of European teams that sort of play each other. And it's funny because I sort of remember you saying that, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And,
well, it just tried seems to make to me, it just seems to me that once you turn the thing into fundamentally a business and you have owners coming into clubs, buying them as investments, not because they love the club or they've got a passion for the sport or any kind of understanding of the culture from which it comes from, which I suppose the point is you know, that like this Charles Court book is making. It just felt that that's where we're headed. I still think it'll be where we go. I mean, this is looks like it's collapsing spectacularly, and therefore, as I think, as Dan has said, possibly gives us the chance to reset. To all take a step back and say, look, we don't want these people owning football clubs. We need to look at the rules that govern how someone gets to own a Manchester United or a Liverpool or a smaller club. You know, the Americans own Burnley now, don't they? I mean, you know, they're kind of buying them up. You know, a lot of people have been sort of hoping that Gold and Sullivan sell, but to who? You know, who's going to buy a £500 million football club? And why will they want to buy it? And it's
Saudi Arabia.
We've really got to take a step back and say, what do we want out of our game, out of this, you know, and that this there has been this momentary coming together of opposition, hasn't there? Of people who wouldn't, you know, I found myself, you know, loving Gary Neville, which I just never thought I would ever do. I, you know, cheered when Leeds equalised against Liverpool, not just because they helped West Ham out, but because I wanted them all to lose that fucking... I wanted their noses rubbed in. I wanted an instant demonstration of why closed-shop football would be such a bad idea.
I think if it had gone ahead, I just think the way the players and those clubs would be treated at away grounds and just sort of on social media and stuff would be just... awful. I think there would be players that would be, you know, worried about it and would think twice about going to Manchester United, because every time you go and play West Ham, every time you go and play, you know, a team that didn't get in, that you just get shit from the fans and personal shit. You know, when you play for England, the club, you know, if there were England players that were in that six teams that are in the Super League, they're just going to get shit from the fans, I think. It would be a nightmare. I think it would just be a nightmare.
Which I think is why the reaction of a lot of the vast majority of the fans of these six clubs has been so encouraging in a way.
Yeah.
And a positive thing. And one of the reasons why I'd be wary, Dan, about how severe the punishment might be, because the real guilty bastards here are these money-grabbing owners. They're not the whole, you know, it's not the edifice of Liverpool Football Club or Arsenal Football Club. They're not really, you know, Arsenal have had beef, supporters have had beef with Kroenke or whatever his name is for a long while, haven't they? So it's we could be careful we don't unfairly target the wrong people.
No.
True. But at the same time, something has to be done. I mean, you know,
I agree.
Rangers fans were equally punished when their team was plummeted through the leagues, you know, through no fault of their own. You know, there is precedent for this. And yeah, I feel for those other fans as well. But something has to be done. And, you know, we can't just kind of like back out of this and just go, okay, well, we'll forget it never happened. Like it was some sort of fever dream. I mean,
I agree. I totally agree.
I mean, the next time the Premier League chairman meet up, I mean, what's going to happen? What they're going to say? I mean, imagine like the ignominy of surrendering the moral high ground to David Sullivan and having him come over you, like making out that he's some sort of saint. I mean, oh God, I just can't imagine where it goes from
there. Well, there was a leak, wasn't there, out of the meeting that took place today that was mentioned by one of those pods on Sky Sports. And I think it was along the lines that the 14 Premier League clubs are still very keen to work with the six other clubs, but that certain individuals would not be welcome in the room.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in the end, I think really we want these Glazer, these you know, these American super rich, just you know, leeches. We want them.
John Terry. We don't want him in the room.
We certainly don't want him.
Don't want John Terry in the room.
But we, you know, can we force them out? Can they be forced out? I don't know. Will they now want to get rid if they can't realise their franchise dream? What's the point of them investing in? And they're leaking money after the pandemic and the Champions League can't satiate their greed, will they go anyway? I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I suppose we better get back to West Ham and talk about what we think might happen in the game of football that's going to take place on Saturday between West Ham United and the aforementioned racist Chelsea.
Nil-nil with Brighton at half-time, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
Nil-nil.
Interesting. Sort of results helped us as well, didn't they? I mean, you know, the Everton Spurs draw helped us. Liverpool drawing, you know, in our potential chase for Champions League football. You know, we lost that game at the weekend, but actually results kind of favoured us. I don't know. Predictions. Jim.
Oh, just a pure prediction, or do you want me to?
No, let's chat about it for a bit. Yeah, detailed rationale, please, Jim. Detailed rationale from all of you, gentlemen, because I haven't prepared anything.
I think it's another cup final. We've got Ogbonna back. I don't know. It depends a little bit. Depends on who's injured and who's fit, who can walk, let alone run. I think we will play with the kind of passion and commitment that we played with in the second half against Newcastle, and I think we'll get something out of it. I really do. I think we've done quite well against Chelsea in recent years. We should have done better in the away game. We did the double over them last season. They'll struggle to cope with us at set pieces. 1-1.
1-1. 1-1. Pete, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's done us a favour in a way, all the Super League debate. I mean, I do think the players are going to be even more fired up now. I mean, hopefully, I think Cresswell might be back, which would make a difference as a third centre-back. I assume Antonio and Rice will be out. I think Yarmolenko's on the bench. So
I wonder what happened to Masuaku.
Yeah, he had fluid on the knee or something.
Oh, right.
It sounds like it wasn't going to be long term, so he can probably be back. But I think we'll get a draw as well.
You can't have 1-1.
Nil-nil.
Nil-nil. Right. Okay. Dan, what do you think?
I was going to go for 1-1, and then I was going to go for 0-0. So
Dan, I've been over this with you.
3-3.
Why won't you listen to me? I don't make the rules, Dan.
I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be another tough game. I think you know, Chelsea are just a really good defensive side. You know, they don't concede many goals, and I think we'll struggle. I'd be much more confident if Rice was in the team.
Yeah,
obviously. I think, you know, as I think Noble's been great the last couple of games. You know, ropey little first half on the weekend. But I think what's really been shown is how much we missed Rice, how much protection he gives the back four, and how he carries the ball forward and just gets us playing. You know, we had all those years where, you know, we kind of suffered from having such a poor midfield.
Yeah.
And we were meant to sign so many of those strong midfielders that we never did. For most of this season, we've had two pretty much world-class players in our midfield.
Yeah.
We've reaped the benefits. The minute we've had one taken away, it's started to look pretty shaky.
Yeah, it's hard.
Again, and we're kind of going back to those days. So, so I, you know, I would have gone with 1-1. I would have gone with 0-0. I don't think I can go with 2-2, which means I'm going to have to go with like a 1-0 win, I think, for West Ham.
1-0 win. Wow, excellent. I think it'll be 3-2 to West Ham. just to continue the run of 3-2 score lines, I'm going to say West Ham United 3, Chelsea 2. They've had a week's rest. Apparently Lingard... It was just cramp at the end of it, you know, because, like, you know, they all had to run a lot more, didn't they, for, you know, for being 10 men for 60 minutes. I thought Bowen had a good game. I thought Bowen was good, you know. He'll be up for it. So,
They were great. I mean,
3-2.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's probably it for this week's Stop Hammer Time. My name is Phil Whelans, and with me have been, as always, Jim Grant.
Cheerio.
Pete May.
Thanks.
And Dan Silver.
All right.
Come on, you irons.
This is a Playback Media production. Get all the associated links for this podcast at westhampodcast.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.